Hello, world. Welcome to On the Menu with Ann and Peter Haig.
Well, you came in kind of loud today.
I did?
Yeah, you came in loud.
Well, oh, I wasn't sure.
I have to try and tone you down a little bit, but that's okay. We're sweet this
Again.
Week, too.
Yeah, well, a little bit.
Yeah, mostly. And certainly sweet starting out with iconic, I guess.
Also.
An iconic, I guess you could call it, at a very young age, an iconic chef called Christina Tosi, who has the unusual privilege of working with uber restaurateur David Chang.
And she has a whole series of her own pastry shops now.
Yes, she does, called Momofuku Milk Bar. And we found out all about it, and I'm sure you'll be fascinated with the story.
I've been really looking forward to this interview with Christina Tosi, because it's taken me a long time to really understand what the Momofuku Milk Bar was all about. Now, in her new book called Simply Milk, Christina walks us through in her introduction to how it all started. And the way it started, Christina, is really not a linear thing, is it?
No, it's not at all linear. It's sort of the unorthodox story of how this bakery and this pastry program for a restaurant group that had no desserts whatsoever, how it all began. And it was so unintentional from every angle that the story of it is just sort of this very hodgepodge collection of events that somehow turned into this bakery that's open and this pastry program for a variety of restaurants. And we now have four milk bar locations in New York City.
Why do you think it's so hot? Something that tastes like the milk at the bottom of your cereal bowl, you wouldn't think would have a lot of sex appeal.
Yeah. I think, God knows, it's sort of become its own monster on that level, but I think that my approach to the items on our menu is just sort of coming about it very honestly. I was a home baker and a lover of baked goods before I was anything else. And so I really try to stay true to that approach and that sort of connection with baked goods. And some of it's a little crazy. The home bakers are crazy. You do stuff.
Yeah, we interview a lot of them.
Home. Yeah.
Sandra Bullock's sister is one in Vermont.
Amazing. And so I think that that's sort of like, that's our approach to food. That's our approach to baked goods and the baked goods that we have at our bakery. That's the approach in the cookbook. And it's just sort of this honest storytelling of why we put cornflakes in our cookies or why we have a cookie that has coffee grounds and oats and graham cracker crumbs and all these things in it. And it's just, we are a classically trained group of pastry chefs that have a real love for baking, and we were home bakers before we were anything else. So I think that's the appeal beyond anything else. And I think we also get sort of a little, like, dash of the Momofuku hype stirred into the mix, which is, you know, all thanks to Dave.
But you did start out in a thoroughly rational fashion with one of the more rational chefs that we know, good old Wiley Dufresne.
Oh, he's a brainiac, Wiley.
There is. I worked for Chef Wiley for a good while, and I learned so much in working for him. He is a real brainiac, and he approaches food with the same love, first and foremost, the love behind it love towards it, and then he just puts such an amazing spin on the way he thinks about food and the way he puts together his love of food and how he presents it. I think working for him and being influenced by that really did, again, we're not serving you cornflakes and then a side of milk. We're serving you this milk that tastes like what's left after you eat all the cornflakes out of it. And we served it that. And I think I got a lot of that sense of humor and the approach of it and the thinky approach.
Isn't he funny?
Wiley. He is.
Have you been by Dewey's new sandwich shop yet?
No, I haven't. He served his short rib sandwich at the San Gennaro Festival in Little Italy last month. And it was one of the most delicious sandwiches.
Really?
Yeah, it was a real great teaser to sandwich shop.
Now tell us a little about, because the organization of this book is very important. Can you tell us how you organized it?
Absolutely. I think it's a great sort of way to retrace how the entire sort of Momofuku Milk Bar came to be. And it stemmed from very simple, basic recipes. I was hired at Momofuku to not be the pastry chef, just sort of help Dave organize the company a little bit and just do any sort of job, big or small. And once there was the realization that I loved to bake, I sort of got thrown into the kitchen to make desserts for these restaurants and then inevitably to open a bakery. And it was just me from the beginning. So I was taught to be a smart kid growing up from my parents, and I was taught to be a very intelligent cook when I worked with Smiley. So my approach was very simple, and it was that I needed to start with basic recipes, and instead of having 100 recipes to make these desserts, I needed to have basic recipes that I could, on many different levels, to create these larger sort of dessert menus and this bakery. So the book is broken down into these very basic recipes, and I call them mother recipes. And it's sort of with the same approach to French cooking as the mother sauces, where every French sauce is thought to be a derivative of one of these mother sauces. And if you can master these mother sauces, there's nothing in French cooking that you can't do. And I really loved that thought, that sort of approach to it, and I really related to it in the kitchen because that's literally how I had to stay afloat at the beginning. So everything is broken down into these different recipes or techniques within our bakery, and there's 10 mother recipes, and one of them is a crumb, and one of them is a crunch, and one of them is cereal milk, because we make this milk that tastes like what's left in the bottom of your bowl after you eat all the cornflakes out of it, and then we make it into not just this drinking milk, we make it into ice cream, we make it into a panna cotta, we make it into an ice cream pie, you can make it into a milkshake, you can make it into a cocktail, and so all of a sudden this one recipe now has 6 or 7 new life. And so that's the approach to it. And you start at the beginning of each chapter learning about this one recipe or this one technique. And then you basically trace my footsteps in how I've repurposed it, whether by changing the flavor and keeping the technique the same or seeing how far I can take this sort of like little crummy cluster of chocolate and how many things I can put it into and how many sort of plated desserts and how many baked goods it appears in on our menu. And it's a really honest approach to the way that we organize the kitchen.
Is this your mother's picture in here?
That's my mother's picture.
Oh, how cute.
In our fudge sauce chapter. She's a hot fudge fanatic. She raised me, of course. But she raised me to be a great person, and she raised me to love baked goods, but her approach to baked goods is a little different than mine. She loves it for the nurturing and thoughtful aspect behind it, but sort of the end result and the flavor is not really her priority. It's more about baking for people that you care about and the nurturing sort of approach to it.
Now, texture seems to be really important to you.
It is. I am a really big fan of crumb and crunch and sandy, and I feel like I often get the question, what's the most important thing in a good dessert or in a successful dessert? And I think flavor, of course, is first, but very often right behind that for me is texture. I am just a creature of texture.
I'm looking at this apple pie layer cake, and like many of your desserts, it's crummy. Lots of crumbs everywhere.
Yeah, so we have this apple pie cake, and it's basically our love for apple pie and then deconstructed. I think that our approach at Momofuku Milk Bar is that it's not just your average bakery. So
no, I wouldn't say that.
We're not going to serve apple pie, but we'll take our love for apple pie and we'll deconstruct it into a layer cake.
Now, you also like nut brittles or brittles, don't you?
Yeah, brittles are another great way to get texture into baked goods.
Oh, yeah. Who's the one we love, the brittles we want? Annette's
brittles.
Annette's chocolate. Her brother, Brett, makes brittles. That sounds like a little rhyme thing. Annette's chocolate, her brother. Fabulous things like champagne or Chardonnay and the brittle.
Brittles are so multifunctional. And like you said, you can just have them with a glass of champagne. And they're real texture.
No, they actually put spirits in their brittle.
Oh, they put spirits in their brittle.
Yeah, there's one called micro brew something or other.
Yeah, he made a beer brittle, and then he didn't want to cut off his connection with winemakers since his shop's in Napa, California. So he decided to make a Chardonnay brittle, which is pretty good too.
Yeah.
Amazing.
So how many new recipes do you have to come up with?
Like on a daily basis?
Yeah, because you have things that are icons. and desserts that probably everybody wants to order. Like, explain your volcanoes.
Our volcanoes are a basic bread dough. We call it the mother dough, and it's wrapped around a potato gratin that has layers of like a smoky pancetta, Gruyere cheese, and it's sort of just like this eruption of a potato gratin within this like bread bowl, if you will.
Huh. And then your crack pie. Everybody would order that, wouldn't they?
It sounds illegal somehow.
It's a hot item, for sure.
So I guess what I'm asking you is, don't people just order the same things over and over and over again from you?
They do. We did so much menu development and recipe testing and new menu additions when we first opened, and I think that's where a lot of the recipes in the cookbook come from. And the more that we sort of do menu development and recipe testing, the harder it becomes, because people become so attached to these things. They become so attached to the crack pot or to the bagel bomb or the compote. They oftentimes are so attached that they don't necessarily want to try something new, and they certainly don't want to know that their favorite cookie or their favorite slice of pie has been replaced. So we typically do menu changes, and we trade a one pie for another pie. There are certain things that never come off the menu, but it gives us the ability to continue creating, but to also have standard, like the milk bar staples and the milk bar favorites always on the menu. And if the chocolate cookie's gone or the cinnamon bun pie's off the menu for a few months, it's just for a few months, and it always mixes with that.
Yep. Looking at this photograph of this cornflake chocolate chip marshmallow cookies, how it's just broken with the marshmallow stretching across the pieces.
Mm-hmm.
They just had a whole article in the New York Times, I think, was it Sunday, about these, what are they called, tabletop directors who actually staged this kind of photography. And it's, did you see that?
I did. I saw it. I think it was like on the front of the business or something of the Sunday Times. I thought it was so interesting. I think the styling of food and stuff like that is such an interesting craft, and it's right.
Well, you've done that, too. You've done just about every aspect of this. Well, I'm very impressed with how you've set off and what you've done, and you have a whole career ahead of you yet, too. So can people make these easily or not?
They absolutely can. We were just, I'm just down in the kitchen this morning working on a new cookie and just figuring out where I wanted to start. And the funniest thing is I took the cookbook and I had it on my desk and I brought it downstairs and just used it as a starting point. So I think my real hope for it is that it becomes sort of like a kitchen companion, and it becomes the cookbook that you bring out when it's time to bake for a bake sale or the holidays or just because you feel like. And the cookbook itself is meant to be that sort of baking companion. It's also meant to be a really fun sort of story about how it all happened by sheer happenstance and just a love and a real drive for sweets and desserts and cookie dough. And I hope that it's more than just a cookbook for many. For me, it's a lot more than that, but I hope it starts as a cookbook. And
well, I think it's a wonderful cookbook. You sound like you're having a wonderful time. The recipes are really, I think that they really will grab at people who want to just dabble in their kitchens. And yet, I mean, listeners, don't think that these are not sophisticated dishes, because they are. A lot of thought behind them.
There's so many possibilities for them that if you're just looking for a little project or a big project, there's sort of something for everyone in the book, and you can sort of start with the basic recipe. And if you decide you just want to make a cookie today, that's great. If you decide you're going to have sort of like a lavish dinner party, there's a challenge in there for you.
Well, bake every day is your message.
There you go. That's right. I sure do.
Well, I look forward to actually trying the milk. Can we get in?
Absolutely.
Oh, good. Okay.
Absolutely. 7 days a week, we're open till midnight.
Well, Christina, what a pleasure for us and for everybody who gets this book. Called Milk, Mama Fuca Milk Bar, and it's Christina Tosi, I would say pastry chef par excellence.
There you go.
Thank you.
Thank you so much for having me.
And stay with us because we'll be back after a short break.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
Welcome back. And I can promise you that the next segment is one of the maddest that we have ever had the opportunity to record.
Well, but you know, if somebody doesn't realize that there's this huge revival of interest in Jell-O and jellies and enjolet, but this book is revelation. I can't stop looking at it.
I think the people who produced this book just went a little extreme. We'll see after you've listened
What's
to it.
What's art form?
We'll see after you listen to it if you agree with me or with Anne.
When we first started talking to the guest we have on the phone right now, I said, Sam Bompas, that sounds a little bit like an Indian cricketer, and you must have one hell of a googly. And you said, well, I don't know what a googly is, but I have a wobbly. perhaps you can explain.
Let me interject that we're talking actually to a master jelly monger, and the book is called Jelly Mongers, subtitled Glow-in-the-Dark Jelly, Titanic Jelly, Flaming Jelly, by the world's foremost purveyors, Bompas and Parr. And on the phone, we have half of that duo, Sam Bompas. Sam, how would you like to launch into this subject?
It's a wonderful subject. I guess the first thing is the wonder of jelly, the joy of jelly, especially for us, because we're a little bit bemused by the fact that we've spent the last 4 years of our life making our entire living out of jelly.
Now, you're not talking about the sweet stuff in jars you put on toast.
Yeah, this is, I guess, in America, you would call it Jell-O, but of course that can very easily be confused with the brand there. But what we're interested in is exactly the same. It's a gelatin-based dessert, but we make our jelly scratch, so it's made with very fine fruit. And interestingly, recently we've been getting even more into cocktail-based jelly. So we just think of making a jelly like making a cocktail, and you get some really rather adult and sophisticated, if surprisingly potent, jellies as well.
Oh, I see. So you can sneak a little Hendrick's gin or a little something else that you fancy into the Jell-O and make it even more exciting.
Well, absolutely. And I think it's the good thing about this, though, is that if anyone's sitting there thinking, God, it reminds me of my student days, what a disaster, this actually comes from a really strong background, a strong historical precedent. If you read one of the historic cookbooks like Beaton or Agnes B. Marshall, every single one of her recipes, jelly, will end with, like, now slinging in a full glass of brandy. They're going to be sophisticated as well. The other week, I was cooking for a dinner party, and it's a dinner party for quite a large one, in fact, it's about 50 people. And they were keen on having jelly for every single course. And so we started off when people sat down, they had there was other food as well, of course, but jelly in supporting guises and this dessert. So when everyone sat down, they had a Negroni jelly with a bit of candied orange. Which I think set the tone for the meal. These sort of luridly coloured, like if you see a Negroni, it has a very vibrant red colour. It tastes delicious, very subtle, sophisticated, but it's incredibly potent. But I think everyone went home with smiles on their faces, but woke up with sore heads the next day.
Now, jelly is quite historical. We understand from the background information we got from you that Henry VIII was a lover of jelly.
Yeah, good. Well, absolutely. And we've done loads and loads of research into jelly. We've probably read every document in existence pertaining to jelly, and it's a rather niche subject. There are not that many people as interested or as passionate about it as us, but there should be. Anyway, but apparently jelly predates Christ, and there's even rumours that the Egyptians were keen jelly fans, and it was something that was reserved for their royalty. That said, we've yet to track down an Egyptian hieroglyphic of what
the interesting thing is, we had a guest on the program who is a specialist in making gelato, and he said that was actually invented for Catherine de' Medici in Italy during the late Renaissance, and she actually took the recipe for gelato and the recipe for ice cream with her when she was the Queen of France.
I've heard about that, but literally even before that, jelly was sort of universal across Europe, and the reason for this is because basically if you heat anything up that's collagen-rich, if you're cooking meat with fat, and then you let it sit, it'll start forming a gel and start jetting. And literally, as soon as man invented fire, you can imagine Neanderthal man, you realize this actually has some preserving properties as well, and is quite delicious. The interesting time for jelly comes when it flips from being the savory stuff, the stuff of terrines, the stuff that actually most people today would find, would maybe raise an eyebrow and not be so keen of those savory jellies, and flips from being that to being sweet jellies. And that was around Catherine Medici's age, the dawn of the Renaissance, and that really is the sugar wave swept across Europe with sugar mania, and people discovered the joys of a sweet jelly.
Because sugar was sort of available at that time. I mean, previously, I guess, there wasn't very much sugar out there.
Yeah, before people would sweeten things with honey. But yeah, so sugar became available. It was also very expensive. It was also seen as an aphrodisiac, which added to its luster and attraction.
And you have a recipe for an aphrodisiac jelly here that are essentially a series of boobs or tits with gold leaf tips.
They're tips.
Exactly,
there.
Right.
They're tips. Let's just make sure where you...
Nipples.
Nipple. Oh, there you go. That one's allowed. The FCC allows that one, I guess.
They work wonders at the end of a meal. During the Renaissance, people retired to a banqueting house and ate sugar, supposedly for its aphrodisiac quality. They would actually have a lot of rather suggestive desserts as well, and we thought it would be great to bring that back. So, very respectfully, with the historical reference as well, we've made tits and nipples.
Tits and nipples.
We've done quite a lot of research into what would be the most seductive jelly possible into all sorts of aphrodisiacal brews and potions. And the thing is, when you start researching, you find that absolutely everything at one point or another in life has been termed an aphrodisiac, but one that is possibly the most successful, certainly the most pervasive, and the most used is alcohol. So again, that...
alcohol. candy is dandy, but liquor is quicker. Do you know that poem?
Mm.
Candy is dandy, but liquor is quicker.
American.
Yes.
That was somebody called.
In many ways, contributed to the.
It was a guy called Ogden Nash.
Yeah. Now let's go back to this. You're talking about flavors and taste, but this whole thing is much more than that. You do performance art. You do development of molds. You have competitions. You do museum performances, special events. Give me that. You're totally mad in a wonderful way, but give us a handle on what the jelly mongers are about.
Well, and a lot of this came out actually out of necessity. When we started doing jellies, we were desperate to use proper molds. You know, like this beautiful antique copper mold that you get on, that you can buy at antique dealerships, market. But we found we couldn't afford them. The very best ones are extortionately expensive.
Mm-hmm.
So that's when my business partner, Harry Parr, incredibly talented, he trained as an architect. He started turning all those things he'd learned as an architect into making jellies. So, you know, using rapid prototyping, 3D printing, and then backforming it. So we found that we're able to make our own jelly mold, sorts of techniques that architects use to design buildings. So that's where we really started. But because what we really wanted to do is make jellies any shape, any size.
How big can you make a jelly?
Well, this is the thing, and this is how we got into the whole sort of performance side of things. The biggest jelly, really, if you want to eat it, is relatively small, only about, say, 15 centimetres in every direction. You can make them bigger, sure, but you have to put so much of a gelling agent in that they become like a rubber ball, like a bouncy ball. You wouldn't want to put it in your mouth. Certainly, if you do it, it's disgusting. It doesn't have that very fine texture. The very, very best jellies are sort of silky and just melt in your mouth. So, yeah, so basically when we found that we could make the jellies, but they're a disappointing mold, that's when we had to start thinking about everything else that goes into the dining experience, making the most of that to give people an awe-inspiring evening out.
But are you more concerned with the diners, the consumers of the food, or the whole display that you do? Like, why do you have fluorescent jellies and the glow-in-the-dark jellies, or you have the fire-on-fire jellies? And you do whole long displays of all these together in a room, right?
Well, I mean, for me, the thing that's absolutely paramount is the diner going away and just saying, God, I went out, I had the most amazing meal, I went to the most amazing show, and just really sort of getting people to light up and delight. Now, a lot of chefs mainly will address that in how they cook the food, what the food tastes like. No, chefs look at what's on the plate. What we like doing is just exploding, you know, what's on the plate into a much grander scale, the rationale being that most people are very, very highly visually articulate. And with jelly, because it's always been shaped by something, it's always figurative, you can make jellies in the shape of things and people really understand them, people really put lights up. First bite you ever have of a dish is always with the eye. And by comparison, people's taste buds, and most people, including people who are professional chefs, mixologists, baristas, you know, really aren't that good by comparison how good they are visually. So we really like to address the visual. That said, it's still got to taste really good at the end of the day.
Now, interestingly enough, you have a picture in your book of a St. Paul's Cathedral jelly. Now, that one I sort of understand, but there's reference, I think Anne got somewhere, to the Millennium Bridge in jelly, and I'm wondering, since that almost fell down anyway, and it certainly wobbled a lot.
It wobbled, yes.
How do you have the secret that Lord Foster doesn't have as to how to stop it?
We ended up almost having it. These came about because we asked, when we wanted to push ourselves as hard as we could on making jellies, we challenged architects around the world to design jelly buildings. He said, you design it, we'll make it. You can just send in even a sketch on a bit of paper. And literally thousands of architects rose to the challenge, which is incredibly exciting for us. And one of the most exciting was Lord Foster, who is known to be one of the top architects in the world. And, of course, as he said, he had designed his Millennium Bridge, the first bridge across the Thames for hundreds of years, and notoriously had to be shut down because it hadn't got the engineering quite right, and it wobbled a lot. He thought it was funny.
I think it's funny too.
I thought it was rather good humour, but I became less amused, though, when we made the first version, and it wobbled so much that he wouldn't sign it off. He wouldn't let us release the image for print because it was such a wobbly, and it was embarrassing.
You'd think if anybody would let it go through, he would.
Exactly. We had to reshoot it five times, and in the end, do our own bit of jelly engineering to get it to stay in the right shape. And if you look carefully at the picture in the jellymonger's book, you'll see that there's a thin perspex rod keeping it in shape.
No kidding.
There were some rather better architectural entries as well, though. And I think one of the most magnificent being a 2-meter-long jelly of the modular, though, so you could manage it, of Barajas Airport in Madrid.
Oh,
by Roger Sir Carbon Partners.
With the little planes. Is that the one in the book?
Yeah, that's the one with all the planes. So if you look at it, if you know the airport in Madrid.
Yeah, we do.
Yeah, somebody bombed it when we were there once.
Ah, brilliant. Well, because for that, the interior of it, the pillars are all different colours. It's a rainbow of colours. And that's used as a wayfinding mechanism for the airport. Now, they matched up those pillar colours to jelly flavours that they then asked us to make. And so we had to literally make, like, 50 or 60 jelly flavours to create this vast spectrum rainbow of a jelly.
Oh, yeah, it's beautiful. I'm looking at it.
Which is great fun, and then we're lucky enough to make it for Lord Roger's 75th birthday party, which is a lot of fun.
You get a lot of special eventing is one of the things you do a lot of as well, right? So we
do special events, we do art exhibitions, we do design exhibitions, but mainly, to be honest with you, we don't care what it is. The most important thing for us is just making something that we'll eat and people will take delight in.
So let's not get away from the fact that this is the definitive book on the most delicious jellies that you could possibly make, and you owe it to yourself to have this as part of your dessert cookbook collection. And Sam, we give our best regards to your partner, whose name I believe is Harry.
And
Harry is not with us today because he's off conquering some other new great height in the world of jelly production or jelly engineering.
Absolutely.
But honestly, listeners, you may not get the full gauge of this, but just from our conversation, but you need to get the book, Jellymongers by Bompas and Parr, And you just won't even believe it. It is so creative, so exciting. And I can hardly wait to see it all in person.
So next
I can't wait to make you a jelly.
We'll be
here in February.
We'll be in London in February or March.
Come swing by the studio then.
Yeah, we'll be in touch with you when we have plans that are firmer.
Okay. Yeah, that sounds great.
Yeah, now, do you get hired by special events planners?
Yes, sometimes.
Okay.
We do quite a lot of, and the projects that I really love that we come up with and then execute ourselves. And yeah, as with anything, we get more and more ambitious. So most recently flooded the roof of Selfridges, the large pub store in London, to make a boat up barn, basically. But of course there was jelly there too, as well as a good excuse for a good jelly.
Have you showed Thomas Keller your jellies?
Not yet. He's over in London.
He's at London. Where is he?
He's at Harrods.
At Harrods, with a special dinner.
Very controversial there.
$1,200 lunch, you think that's excessive?
Yeah, it was absolutely, absolutely wild.
He's good.
There's nothing more that I'd love to go and eat at the French Laundry. But I had a very well respected British journalist in the studio yesterday, and he was raging against the charges. And he'd been offered
Was it Richard Vines?
It wasn't Richard Vines.
Because he seemed to absorb it all right.
No, Richard's brilliant. I saw him in last July. Mm-hmm. He was happy on the roof. We weren't charging anything there.
Yeah, he was happy.
Jay Rayner. He's a very good journalist.
He rages about everything. Jay.
It makes a good rage makes for a good read.
Right. Well, listen, we probably have a lot more to talk about and a lot more in common, but I'm glad to get the dialogue started, and we need to get all of our listeners started in on the big rush to the reestablishment of the jelly or angelet or jello tradition. And so they do that by buying this book and reading it, and I think everybody will just get knocked out by it. So thank you very much.
Well, thank you very much. We'll see you in February then.
We will, Sam. Well, indeed.
So what do you think? Well, I guess, you can let us know what you think about the jellymongers. We're going to visit with them in person, and maybe we'll bring back even more excitement.
Did you know that they just completed the first worldwide jello mold competition?
This is hot stuff. I'm pleased it's hot stuff. I'm absolutely delighted that there's been a revival of jelly. And I'm sure listeners, you will be fascinated too, and you want to go out and start working in the field, just like our last guest. But I guess now it's time to take a break, and we'll be right back after.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
Welcome back. Here we are again, and we're staying on part of the same theme with our next guest.
Well, actually, until we interviewed our next guest, I didn't know that he had actually worked with our previous guest, the Jellymongers.
I bet they know Paul Young too.
Yeah, they're all Brits.
They're all Brits. They're all close together. They're all in London or the London area, and
they're all extraordinary.
Yeah, eccentric.
Extraordinary is the title of the book.
Extraordinary food, and Stefan Gates, all the way from London, explaining why the book came about and what it contains to help you to do exactly what he describes, which is to make your friends think you're an absolutely wonderful chef.
Stefan Gates, I told your publicist this book certainly is called Extraordinary. Extraordinary, I guess. I said it certainly was. And subtitled, it is a cookbook, but it's really an idea book as well, I think you'd agree. And it's subtitled, How to Make Meals Your Friends Will Never Forget. And believe me, if you have them all sitting on their sandwiches, they probably won't. That's the bum sandwich.
The English are known to be eccentric.
Yeah, well, I mean, we seem to be having a run in these.
Yeah, there being only one exception that I can think of who's on this program, the other one is certainly eccentric.
Now, tell me who this book is for. I know, Stefan, you are a broadcaster for the BBC and some other programs also, right? And
That's
a food
right.
writer.
Yeah, I'm a food writer and a TV presenter, but I'm interested in the fascinating side of food. I mean, I need my food to be delicious and healthy and tasty, but I need it to be fascinating as well, because I think it's just such a lovely thing to be able to do, to use the things that we do every day to shine a bit of extra light in our lives. And I want my food to be extraordinary and fascinating and to have an extra dimension rather than just being fuel to get you through the day. And so I like to play with my food, I guess.
Well, you certainly do.
It's a naughty idea, you know, the idea of playing with your food. But when you play with your food, when you make it something more than the sum of its parts, you shine this extra light on this area of our lives that we spend so much time on every day. And I think we should use the time that we eat to do something fascinating, to do something a bit unusual with our food, to make our lives a little bit extraordinary. So the book is, I guess the book sort of, there are three different things. There are some absolutely insane, crazy recipes in there. There are a lot of interactive recipes in there, and then there's also some things which are just twists on the ordinary food that you do every day. And so some of the mad things are how to cook salmon in a dishwasher and kebabs on a car engine, how to fry an egg on a piece of paper. But
yeah.
Really the meat of it, I think, is these interactive meals where when I get friends around for a dinner, I tell them, bring a hammer with you. Bring a hammer and a shirt that you don't mind getting messy.
Mm-hmm.
And we have a crab and hammer party. And they'll come in, and all they get is a crab and a pot of mayonnaise.
And a hammer, assuming they remember to bring one.
Well, as long as they bring one, yeah. Otherwise, they have to go back home.
Now, this is a little bit like the Goon Show meets Gordon Ramsay.
You know, I'll take that as a compliment.
It was intended as a compliment. It occurs to me that you may not even remember the Goon Show.
Oh, no, I know the Goon Show. But yeah, I guess it's in a spirit of slightly eccentric and having fun with something that we don't normally have fun with. But I think it's really important. When you have your friends and your family around, all the people that you love most, give them a meal that they will remember for the rest of their life. Whether it's you get them to roll their own sushi, or you give them a bum sandwich to eat. A bum sandwich is basically just any sandwich wrapped up in food wrap, cling film, and then sat on. And you sit on it for, I don't know, about 15 minutes, half an hour, depending on how nice and warm your bum is and how much weight you can push down on it. And it warms it up, and flavor volatiles are more active when they're warmer. So it does actually make a sandwich taste a bit better. But for me, there's also a lovely childish element to it as well, because I always used to sit on my sandwiches when I went to school.
So that's how you got the idea.
Yeah, well, I began to think, why do I keep on sitting on my sandwiches? Every day I sit on my, I realized I was doing it on purpose. And I was doing it on purpose because I liked everything being squashed together and to be able to play with a different set of textures to a normal sandwich. And so now I do this a lot with my friends and also with my kids. My kids love doing this. Whenever we have a sandwich, we wrap it up and sit on it first. And it is just a sandwich, but it transforms the experience of eating into something more than the sum of its parts, just a little bit extraordinary. And it makes life sparkle a little bit more. It makes life crackle because you've got in touch with the food that you eat.
But if you have adult dinner guests, are they also thrilled to have to be in preparing this? We once had a mussel party in D.C., and that was before we got farmed mussels, so they were all covered with barnacles. And,
oh, brilliant.
Yeah, and so we had the scrapers, and as people came in, we handed them the mussels, a bucket, and the scraper. And I'm not so sure they really liked that very much.
But I'm pretty sure
they didn't.
Start off with people are a little bit scared. They're a little bit worried, and they think, well, hang on, what's going on? But I think people get into it, and people, it transforms a meal into a party, because people are involved with their food. With people who've never met each other, there's a connection that you can make between each other. And you're being tactile. You're touching the food that you eat. So many times you get given a plate of food. It's very formal, and you put your fork in it, and you don't touch it until it hits your tongue. Now, and that's a lovely thing as well. But when you actually make your own sushi rolls, when you dip your own shabu-shabu into the stock, and, you have to fight to get your own bit back, it just transforms the experience. I think everyone has a better time when they're involved at some level in the making of the food.
I like your musical instruments idea.
Hey, I've got one here. I've just made it for you.
What is it?
While we were chatting, so it's a carrot.
Okay.
A lovely fat carrot, organic, bought from the Chelsea market just now. And so I've sliced one end off and sliced the other end off, and I've drilled a big hole using my massive drill. And you drill a really big hole down one end, and then a small hole down the other, and then you get a piece of straw, and you cut the end off so it makes a little V, and then you get a carrot, and I hope this doesn't blow your microphone, but this is what it sounds like.
Oh, that's pretty good.
Sounds like an almost dead cat.
It's certainly a dead carrot, that's for sure. But when you get about 20 of these together, when you have friends around for a party and everyone plays their own, then it just, you know, you can play the national anthem on these things.
that's important, not for tradition,
but...
No, it's fair to... We should also say that this book is not entire madness. There really are some very sensible and very interesting recipes.
Tasty, yeah.
Especially earlier in the book. I think when you get towards the end, you sort of let loose a little bit.
I go a bit wild. But yes, I mean, there's lots of things that I think that some people may have tried, like just the simple act of eating a whole artichoke. So instead of having an artichoke heart, you take the whole artichoke and you boil the whole thing up and everyone gets their own artichoke. It's a very simple thing. There's nothing...
Yeah, well, this our son's favorite food in four-year-old preschool. Everybody gave their favorite food, and he said his favorite was a whole steamed artichoke with escargot butter.
Brilliant! That's what I want to hear! and my kids love them, and it's because they're playing with it. You know, they're ripping each leaf off and dipping it in butter, and they're deconstructing this thing. And so it's a really simple thing to do, but it's just a way of transforming things so that they take on a different life. You know, get a fish, wrap it, and make little foil parcels with aluminium foil and put different flavorings in each one so that you never know who's going to get what. And it's just a way, I think it's just a different way, different take on food, so that you think about it again, so that you can see it for the adventure that it is, and so you can just shine a bit of fascination on your meals.
Now, you really cover the globe, too. You're not just saying this is eccentric British food. Anne has the page open at Beer Can Chicken.
That's one of yours!
Yeah, we make all, yeah, exactly. We have the regular thing. You know, they have a utensil for that.
That's
now.
Right. I saw it. I found it online, and I was going to buy it, and then I thought, no, it works just fine with a can.
I think it's... I would highly recommend it because
it's really good.
You don't lose anything.
And if it does fall over when the chicken changes shape in the oven, disaster.
Well, no, it stands straight up just nicely, but you don't have to worry about putting it on a baking sheet or anything like that. It comes with a reservoir.
Brilliant.
You pour the beer in the bottom of the reservoir.
Yeah.
I'm doing it now almost once a week, and it's about the only way I do chicken because it comes out so deliciously
moist
all the way through.
Well, you have to talk to the chicken because it's sitting properly up there, you know.
Oh, yes, yeah, you have to get it in just exactly the right position.
You've got to get worried.
And then you also have a turducken in there too.
That's right, yeah.
Oh, those are crazy, aren't they?
My best turducken, I think, was a 9-bird roast.
Shoot.
One Christmas. It took me half a day, but we had a great fun doing it. My kids helped me do it.
Now, so you didn't deep fry yours?
No, we didn't deep fry it, actually. We roasted it.
Because that's the approved Louisiana method.
You
burn your house down by splashing hot fat all over it.
Hours of fun for all the family. Yeah. Yeah, I mean, the other thing that's a classic American one is cooking kebabs on a car engine.
Oh, right.
Which is a lot of fun. It's best done in the summer, but it works throughout the year. But great book called Manifold Destiny, which is an American book, all about how to use your engine for cooking with.
I don't think we've seen that one. Few things escape us, but that one has.
It's a fringe interest.
Maybe it didn't sound like something we really wanted to do.
I love this pints of shrimp. I mean, aren't they gorgeous?
Yeah, and again, very simple, and everyone has had shrimp before, and it's a simple thing to do. But again, put that on the table with your friends. And they're fiddling with their food, and they're playing with it, and they're throwing their bits into a bowl in the middle of the table, and it just transforms life. It meals just sparkle, and that's what I want to get out of my food.
And are they really, your guests really excited about getting jellyfish?
A lot of my guests are quite wary when they come round. They literally come through the door saying, oh, God, what now?
Especially if they've been before.
Yeah, exactly. I've got an 8-year-old and a 6-year-old daughter, and when their friends come round, they're terrified, absolutely terrified of it. That they're going to be given roasted grasshoppers and
Well, see, that's... I just opened the book to this. You have a section on weird and wonderful snacks, including insects. And I mean, that's one of the things that keeps coming up over and over and over again because it's inexpensive.
That's right.
And also, it's very nutritious.
Yeah.
I can eat almost anything, but I can't... I cannot get my head around that.
Well, I think it's one of those things that it will have, it'll take a long time for them to really come into the diet for the West. But the insects are so efficient at transforming vegetable matter into protein. And so as the world's resources become more and more scarce, it's a pretty, who knows?
I think we're the only ones that don't eat insects.
Yeah.
Yeah, Western Europe and Americans.
That's right.
I mean, even Central and South Americans eat insects.
That's right. Some of my favorite ones are from Mexico. Chapulines.
Oh, yes.
Which are, I think they're fantastic.
Yes.
Lime roasted.
Are they like giant grasshoppers?
Yes.
Yeah, and they have to pull the legs off, the front leg, the big legs.
Well, see, that's one of the things that got me concerned. I was interviewing somebody who said that one of the problems was that the legs tended to get caught in your teeth.
They can, yeah, because you've got the little barbs on. And once they go down one way, they can get trapped.
Oh, dear.
So look, take them off before you try. But, I mean, the other thing is you can grind them out down into a powder and you can make a little burger out of them and stuff like that. I really like them. They're, it's like eating crisps. I think they're good fun and they're tasty. And, again, if you serve them to people, it just transforms the experience of eating. Just a little pot of something extraordinary, whether it's some padron peppers or some insects or just something that people really sit up and wake up at the start of a meal. I find just transforms the whole eating experience.
Now, you're in New York right now. Having conquered England, are you about to try and conquer the United States as well?
I don't know about conquer. Maybe shine a little bit of light onto some people's meals. I've been wandering around New York for the last couple of days, and people here are obsessed with food, you know?
They are, yes.
I just hear, as I walk down the street, people talking about what they're going to have for lunch and talking about, you know, I was just out just now, and I heard some people talking about fried oysters, and I wanted to try and follow them to find out where it was that they'd eaten their fried oysters.
Oh, they're wonderful fried
and
oysters.
And I really hope that this approach to food will strike a chord with people who are already fascinated with food. And that's what I love about the modern world. I think over the last 10 years, 15 years, we've had a resurgence in interest in what food can do and what food can be and how exciting it can be. And you know, there are a lot of people moralizing about food and about diets and things like that. But I just want people to enjoy it, to have fun and to have some extra sunshine in their
Well, wow. There's certainly a lot of extra sunshine in this book. And I'm guessing if you spend more than a few more days in the United States, you'll have enough material for Extraordinary Food Book 2.
Yes, that's what I'm after.
Great.
Well, it's been a delight, Stefan, talking to you.
It's been so nice talking to you guys.
And yeah, and good luck with your book. Again, it's called Extraordinary Cookbook, How to Make Meals Your Friends Will Never Forget. And this is true. So, go play your carrot.
In carrot.
Okay. Thanks, Stefan.
Thank
bye-bye.
You very much. Bye-bye.
And we'll be back after a short break.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
Welcome back. And if you think our last two guests called us from a long way away, how about someone who's so enthusiastic about what she does, she called it all the way from Singapore.
Right. Did you realize when you set up the tracks for the interview that we have three Brits on here? Three.
We clustered them in the program. Well, after all, Britannia rules the waves and all that stuff.
Yeah.
There we go. Well, here's more evidence that Britannia does indeed rule the waves, because all the way from halfway across the world to Singapore, Gilly James came to talk to us about her latest book and her adventures in preserving things.
We have a caller on the line now from, actually calling us from Singapore, no less, although she is English, Gilly James. Congratulations on the book that I have in front of me, Jam, Jelly, and Relish, subtitled Simple Preserves, Pickles, and Chutneys, and Creative Ways to Cook with Them. And also, I understand you have a new book that I'm going to get called Fresh from the Freezer, which does the same thing, demystifying the preserving methods. Is that correct?
That's right.
Well, welcome.
Thank you.
How do you like Singapore?
I love Singapore.
Oh, that's
great.
So far,
so good. I've only been here 3 months, but so far I love it. And sun always shines, so that's always a good thing.
Nice. Yes. So you haven't been through your first rainy season in Singapore yet?
Well, we have a bit of rain here and there, but the lovely thing is it seems to come in large bursts and then it goes away again for a few days. So it doesn't seem to affect our life too much.
Well, he was attracted to your book. It has a quote on it from Jamie Oliver that says, "This lovely book puts a smile on my face." And I thought that was really nice. And you also had an endorsement from Dory Greenspan, who's one of my most favorite cookbook authors around my French table. She's one of those whose recipes always work. So I'm trusting that your recipes also in this book will work.
Well, I hope so.
Now,
the
operative word here is simple, and you are simplifying what it takes to preserve, which is, of course, everybody's now back to preserving, right?
Yeah, I think it seems to have suddenly come into fashion again, and everybody's picking their sort of seasonal fruits and vegetables and wanting to know what to do with them. So I was trying to demystify sort of whole idea of preserving, because I don't know about you, but in the past I've sort of thought about it and thought, gosh, that's going to need an awful lot of equipment, and I need to know what monitor to buy and all sorts of bits and bobs. And the more and more I looked into it, the more I realized that actually it is quite a simple process. And as long as you've got a large preserving pan and some sauces to put in the fridge so that you can test if your jam is set, that's pretty much all you need, apart from obviously the lovely ingredients that you're going to turn into jam or chutney or whatever.
I actually watched my mother and grandmother preserving, and it seemed like a very complicated business, and there was always the danger of not getting the jars properly sanitized.
Yeah. Well, again, there are a million one ways to do these things, but I tried not to give every single option, and I just went through all of them and decided which one I thought was the simplest and stuck with that in the book. And with sterilizing, I think as long as you've got sort of clean, dry jars, you then just put them in the oven and on a low temperature for a few minutes. And as long as you spoon your jam into your jar when the jar is still warm, then you shouldn't have any problem with things going moldy or that sort of thing. But I think one thing that you just need to make sure, you don't necessarily have to buy brand new jars, but just check that the seal on the jar still works and it's not sort of come off, or some old jars get a bit rusty, and I think it's probably time to throw those away and invest in some new ones.
Well, so you simplify what equipment you're going to need to approach these preservation methods.
Yeah.
And you also arrange the whole book by season, because that's the whole idea, that you're preserving seasonal produce.
Yeah, I'm a huge fan of seasonal eating, and one of the things that I mention in the introduction to the book is the fact that seasonal food is when everything tastes at its peak, and it's crazy for people to be rushing out and buying sort of jarred tomato sauce when in fact if they sort of prepare ahead, pick the tomatoes when they taste fantastic and jar them themselves, and they can have all year round delicious pasta sauces and things. So, I've done it in season just because I thought that would be the most helpful way for people to look things up. And I picked stuff from my garden, really, as the year went through and I was testing all the recipes, and helped out by a few friends who had nice veg patches and
nice
orchards and things. Yeah, and so I think it sort of works doing it seasonally because it reminds people when the food tastes at its best, really.
You seem to like vodka.
You've noticed my weakness.
What does that have to do with preserving?
It's in here. There's all these recipes.
Limoncello, and I think the one I've done in the book is called Raspberry Cello.
Right.
And it's fantastic. Definitely recommended. And you can make the most fantastic sorbet as well using the Raspberry Cello. And you hardly know the vob there.
Okay, so you're just using it as a neutral spirit to get the flavor.
Exactly. So really the main taste you get when you taste the vodka is just an amazing hit of raspberry. And you can also, you can do it with all sorts of different fruits. You can take your pick, really.
Well, there are a number of recipes here that I would really like to try, such as sweet and sour pickled vegetables.
Yes.
The other thing is that what's different about this book is you show how to use them in actual recipes, so there's not just eating things out of a jar.
Again, I was hoping that would be a helpful thing for people, because make tons and tons of these jams, chutneys, and put them all in the cupboard, and then sort of can forget about them. And I just thought it would be handy to give people some ideas of how they can turn them into other things. So some of the raspberry jam I think I use in a queen of puddings, which is one of my all-time favourite puddings that I used to eat as a child, and I've made a fool using some of the poached gooseberries and an upside-down marmalade cake using which of the marmalade you like, and a marmalade tart as well, which is a sort of variation of the classic lemon tart, but with marmalade sort of mixed into it as well. And some savoury things too, just because I think people often sort of only use preserves in sweet things, but in fact chutneys, I've chutney to put in some sausage rolls, and I've dried some orange peel, and I use that in a sort of beef casserole.
Oh, that's good. Yes,
this gives a really subtle hint of orange coming through.
You have a strawberry and rose petal syrup that looks just heavenly.
Great, just drizzled over fruit salad, actually, just mixed in with other fruits. But it looks very pretty if you make meringues and then pour the syrup over the white meringues and the cream. But there's a whole variety of things you can do with the preserves. I've just tried to help with a few sort of my favourites.
Now, what should I do with my... I had a whole pile of fennel, bronze fennel, and I freeze the fronds, but I now have, they went to seed because it was such a hot summer, and now I have, and we use a lot of fennel seed in cooking. How do I preserve them?
The seeds?
Yes.
Goodness me, now you're asking.
Oh.
I haven't ever actually dried seeds. I would imagine just putting them in the airing cupboard on a tray on some kitchen paper, and just slowly drying them out that way, and then put them in a sterilized jar and just use them as you need them.
Okay.
No, Anne's not too sure what an airing cupboard is. I know what it is.
I know what it is.
She does know what it is. Okay.
But what do you call an airing cupboard in America? A laundry cupboard?
But I have an old stove in an unused room that has a pilot light, and it stays warm, and I put things in there.
That sounds perfect.
It is.
That sounds absolutely perfect. I haven't ever done it, though, guessing, but that should be a fairly easy one to test out overnight and see how it goes.
Yeah, well, I was going to do that, and then I asked somebody who's into foraging and preserving and stuff, and he said I had to blanch the seeds, and that seemed to defeat the whole purpose of drying them.
Yes, and also you worry if you blanch the seeds that some of the flavor will be lost.
Exactly.
Well.
Now, you have, one of my favorite things is the green tomato pickles. And you have the preserved green tomatoes. But I was just wondering, because when we were going off to the UK, actually, and so we picked all the green tomatoes so that they wouldn't go to waste. And what I did was I just put them in a freezer bag, washed them, dried them, put them in a freezer bag, and shoved them in the refrigerator till I need to use them in the winter.
Perfect.
So do you have things like that in your new book, Fresh from the Freezer? What unusual things do you do, since I don't have that book yet? What unusual things do you do?
I've got various sort of things, from easy batch cooking recipes for people to make stashes of delicious tomato sauce and various other chicken casserole and a sort of all-seasons mince that you can make for all recipes, really. I think I've called it all-purpose mince, which is suitable for turning into all sorts of pasta dishes and that sort of stuff.
Huh?
And then I've got a section in it with soups and starters and nibbles, which obviously is quite handy when it comes up to Christmas time. You can get yourself prepared ahead and put them all in the freezer, and then all of the recipes have sort of defrosting or even cooking from frozen instructions. And then I have a large section at the back, which is for babies and toddlers, which is trying to help mums out there like me who don't have much time. And so I've got some purees that I did for their baby when she was growing up, and then various sort of toddler meals that are easy to sort out of the freezer as and when you need them.
Well, you sound like you're really helping us all, Julie.
I hope so. My favourite section in the book, though, has got to be the puddings, and there's a large amount of ice creams and sorbets and things in there, and none of them require an ice cream maker.
Oh, no, that's good.
I found an ice cream that doesn't need churning, which has got a sort of secret couple of ingredients in that means that you don't have to churn them. So there's lots and lots of different flavours, including and honeycomb, and there's a blackcurrant and redcurrant ice cream in there for those who like to use up their blackcurrants and their redcurrants in different ways.
Well, Julie James, let's repeat your books for our listeners. The one on preserving is Jam, Jelly, and Relish, and the other one is Fresh from the Freezer. And I'm imagining that this next book out is going to be introducing us to some Southeast Asian cuisine.
Could well be. You have to watch this space. I'm not quite sure at the moment myself. We're just discussing the next book, so I shall keep you posted.
Thank you, and enjoy Singapore.
Thank you so much.
Thank you, Julie.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
So that's it for today's program. We hope you'll join us again, same time, same place, next week.
Bye-bye.